Blog Talk Radio.
On this dreary, hot, muggy Monday, it is so. I'm just sort of like, I can't believe it. In New York City, here we are, and it's August 1st, isn't it? What is it? Isn't it some?
Yeah.
What day is it?
It's August 1st. Today's August 1st. I can't believe it.
You know, I forgot to wish my cousin Vandy, my big boy Vandy. It was his birthday. Oh my God. Anyway. Is it hot and muggy down in steamy
It's the South. It's like a crock pot, you know. And it's buggy and it's steamy. And there's an odor in the summertime in the South. It's kind of like a musty. I call it the smell of the South. It's like everything that's rotten just starts cooking and percolating and. Yeah, I'm running away. I'm buying a house in New Mexico, and I'm running away. That's my new plan.
When are you doing this, honey?
I am. I'm going to buy myself something out in the. Whoops. Oh, good. Hang on. Well, we were waiting for our guest to call in, and it looks like he slid in under the wire. Let me just catch him for a minute, May, and then we'll get back to our introduction.
Hey, you know.
Talk amongst yourselves.
She's actually going to be buying. Is she really buying this house out in New Mexico?
Hey,
I want to hear
Alan?
About this.
It's Alan.
Hey,
all right,
Alan.
Hang on one sec. Don't go away. Hold on.
So,
Alan must have been getting his coffee. Sitting under the wire. He might have had a scoop. He might have been busy. But anyway, Alan's hanging on. We have Alan Light with us. Remember the last time we had him on, and I mean, this dude, Rolling Stone magazine, Vibe, Spin, but he's also written a bunch of books, and his latest one coming out, What Happened, Miss Simone, is getting a lot of chatter. A lot of people are interested in just how this beautiful soul just evaporated, you know,
right.
And we're going to talk to him in a minute about that, but back to the steamy South.
You're leaving us to go to the hot, dry desert of New Mexico.
Yeah.
What are you doing,
girl?
I'll keep better.
I'll keep better. No, I'm going. I'm going. I got my telescope. I'm going. I'm going to move near Roswell and hope the next spaceship comes to get me because, sister, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to nod out from social media except our show and write the Great Western, and off I go. I'll have plenty of room.
Come visit me first before you decide to, you know, before you take off into Roswell. I mean, I'd like
Yeehaw.
To come visit you in Roswell. I got plenty of stories and seen some stuff. I would love to be out there. You know? So
anyway, let's get our guest on because the last time we had him on, we got a lot of chatter because this guy is not only a brilliant journalist, he's also a really funny dude. So without further ado, we are welcoming back to our show, just sliding in under the wire. He's a journalist, he's an author, and he's editor-in-chief of Vibe and Spin magazines, Alan Light.
Hello, you guys.
Hey.
I am so sorry I got the times messed up, but here I am. So.
That's okay. We got you in. It's fine. We got the chatter. Take deep breaths.
It's like most men in our lives, Alan. Out of breath and late. What can we say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's just holding up my end. That's all.
Alan, before we get into what happened this morning, I want to pick your brain a little bit about this big. This thing about all the musicians and the songwriters and everything—they're not getting their money. What's going on?
Well, that's about a 20-part question. Look, it's all
true.
You know. It's always hard. It's always I think made extra hard, extra complicated for people to, you know, for the lower you go down the chain, it's always harder to come up with the money that you're due. And
mm-hmm.
I
do
think
know that,
that
one.
You know, and I think that when you look at, you know, if you look at the way that, that something like the Spotify business deals are put together, you know, everybody gets mad. Everybody blames Spotify for not paying, you know, not the artists don't get paid, the writers don't get paid. There's a step in between that nobody talks about, which is that the payments from Spotify are made to the labels. The deals that are done with the labels. They are not done with the artists. And then it is up to the labels to determine, you know, how and when they are going to distribute the money that they receive and what each deal calls for. And, you know, so these things are always, it's always one arm's length to another arm's length. And of course it gets, you know, the faucet gets shut tighter and tighter as you go down the, you know, through the whole list. So, look, it's not news that it's, you know, that, that, that the artists get screwed, and it's not news that the songwriters get screwed. The question is, you know, where do you try to tackle that? And I think that there's a lot to look at to say the labels are kicking this up to be a, you know, to be a fight at the, you know, up at the streaming level, when in fact mm-hmm. they got to look at both levels of that. So, you know, it's, look, it's hard. And the way that, you know, I don't think that from my friends who are songwriters and who are fighting this, I think they don't feel like they're getting strong enough representation from the ASCAPs and BMIs of the world, that the ways that other, you know, essentially unions and labor organizations and, you know, the actors union, I mean, comparable creative organizations fight for their members, you know, they haven't seen that. They haven't seen that for writers at their level. They haven't seen that for performers in terms of, you know, touring, you know, the issues and ordeals that, that surround touring and how those deals are structured. I just think that, you know, they don't have a, an organized voice that's been able to be terribly effective at this stuff.
No, I think, you know, it's the same thing May and I've talked about it before in the movie business, and that you're probably aware of it too, Alan. I was at the meeting. Now, this is a long time ago. It was Gaslight, yeah. But I was at the meeting where SAG discussed whether or not we really took cable television seriously.
Right.
I was at that meeting.
Right.
So it's really kind of the same thing. It's a, it's a, it's uncharted territory.
Well,
it's a new frontier, and I don't
and
know.
And you literally
I don't
have
know.
Standard, you know, standard contracts are written that cover existing, you know, existing technology and whatever future technology comes along. You know, contracts are written against, you know, whatever it is that's going to happen in the future. And,
right.
you know, so what are you basing? A lot of these deals are, you know, they're locked in before you even know what it is that you're talking about moving forward. And, you know, it's...
Mm-hmm.
And it's very complicated. I mean, nobody knows how to project this stuff. Nobody knows how to forecast that. So what's the,
nope.
you know, what's the appropriate way to write that? And, you know, and similarly, a friend of mine wrote a story a few months back. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that was, that, you know, wrote about the tour. You know, everybody says the answer to this is, well, you just need to be touring. If your recording revenues are not going to be there, the answer is you just need to be touring more. And he was sort of like, well, what kind of, that's not, you know, that's not a solution. That's particularly mm-hmm. not a solution when you're putting the physical, that means a physical body that has to move around, the, you know, the world night to night. You know, we saw, we've seen in recent years, even the big stars, Adele's voice blows out, Dave Grohl breaks his leg. You know, the physical frailties of human beings, you know, at a certain point kick in, and that is not a viable, you know, you can't maintain that schedule. So it's not an answer to just say you've got to work harder and haul your ass around further to be able to make up that money. That doesn't. That's not sustainable.
Right.
No.
Absolutely.
And
I'm going to share
a little BMI story with you, Alan. It's not directly related to music, but it kind of is related to how the upper echelon of BMI might just view people in general. I was working a coat check not too long ago at a big awards thing, and one of the big muckety-mucks from BMI brought me his camel cashmere coat. which I put in a special place, and I hung it up, and he came out early, and I remembered which coat was his, and I got his coat, and he handed me a $5 bill, and he asked for $3 change.
You know, you don't get there. Okay. Somebody says, why are the guys with all
beat.
The money that cheap? That's how they, how do you get all that money?
No, let me tell you something. I got you guys beat on this one. I mean,
uh-oh.
I went to a dinner, and the people at that time, well, you know, you're thinking early 80s. I get down there, and there was the dinner where I'm coming down with my group of people, and, you know, from United Artists, and I was the East Coast professional manager. And the guy turns around, photographer says, "What group?" You know, they had worn a chapel before me and all this. There was like 13, 14 of us. And the photographer looked into his camera, looked up, and said, "You, get out of the picture." And we're all standing there going, who is he talking to? Lo and behold, I finally figured it out. He was talking to me because he kept saying, get out of the picture. And finally, the whole group just yelled and said, "She is the East Coast professional manager." And they were so somebody came running over and said, "Take the picture." The guy was refusing to take my, because I was in the photo. This right. was an ASCAP dinner. I never gotten so yeah. many people calling me up the next day going, you up for drinks? Do you have time for dinner? I was leaving the next day.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just the most.
Yeah. Well, the BMI dude didn't ask me, didn't call me the next day. I can tell you that. But I did spend his $3 and $2. And, yeah. But, you know, I guess this is probably another whole show that we could talk about this. And I think it is something that does need to be talked about. But right now, first of all, your book on Prince, and then the consequences of what happened was fantastic. But let's talk about Nina Simone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. That's the book came out a couple of months ago. And it was an interesting, I mean, this was a little bit of a sort of an inside out project for me. You presumably know about the documentary that came out about Nina last year, which was nominated for an Oscar and got a tremendous amount of attention and acclaim. And, you know, basically the producers of the film, I think somewhere along the line, you know, as they were starting to show the movie to people, realized that they were going to get some traction and some attention around this thing.
Hello?
You there?
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh,
and sorry, my phone made a weird noise. Realized
right.
that, you know, that they were going to get some attention around the movie, and had the idea that, you know, as you guys know, with any of these films, you do years and years of research and have all of this stuff, and a tiny fraction of that makes it onto the screen. And so I think they thought, well, let's take all of this, all of these interviews that we've amassed and all of these archives and everything else, and try to extend that further. And so they handed over to me all of the research from the documentary and said, well, you know, we made a film out of this, go take this and make a book out of it. And there's so much more information, so much more of a story that you can tell, you know, above and beyond the 95 minutes of a movie, that, you know, there was just all of this other stuff to get into and to explore in her life and her work. And, you know, it was kind of a crazy, very sped up crash of a project, but a, you know, incredibly fascinating and tortured and complicated life to look at. And, you know, so hopefully I did, you know, did justice to her career and to the work that the filmmaker and the researchers put into trying to examine her life.
Do you
yeah.
think that, I mean, truly, honestly, she was born before her time. I, you know, her respect for music and what people thought she should be playing compared to what she really, truly
right.
felt like she was performing was literally night and day, for a bad analogy. You know, it really have to wonder, was she born too soon? You know,
well, I think you hit on, you know, what is really the fundamental tension in Nina Simone's life. You know, she was a very young child prodigy, piano player in a small southern town, in a small segregated southern town. She was trained as a classical player and basically put the whole first part of her life, you know, onto this bet that she would become the first great black female classical piano player that the United States had ever produced. And they raised, you know, they raised money in her town. They had a scholarship fund. The sort of the hopes and dreams of this community were all placed on this little girl. And she, you know, she trained and she trained and studied, and her piano teacher, she, you know, claimed for her whole life as her greatest influence. And then she didn't make the cut at the conservatory that she was planning to attend. And it's very, you know, was this entirely a racist decision? Was the, you know, what, in going back and looking at it, there had been black students there before. There had even been black female students before at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, where she wanted to go. But she believed, the important part is she believed that she didn't get that shot because of her color. And never, you know, never fully recovered from that. And so when she went off, you know, basically to make a buck and started playing in nightclubs in Atlantic City initially, to her, she was always, you know, she wasn't an entertainer, she was an artist. And she always felt that she was due the respect, the attention, you know, the seriousness that classical artists in theater settings deserved, that the audiences should be attentive, that they should be quiet, that they should respect the work. You know, well, you guys know, playing in nightclubs, playing at jazz festivals, that's not the way it works. Working for recording, you know, recording for commercial record companies, that's not the way it works. And I think she never, you know, she was never able to resolve this sense of that she was, you know, that she had moved to playing on a different field. She was always angry about that. She was always dissatisfied by that. And that never, ever went away until she, you know, just walked away from it and really, you know, stopped making music for a long, long time, combined with the emotional problems and mental issues and, you know, illnesses that she was battling. It all just, you know, that all just became too much, and it just overtook her until she really couldn't get herself out there to do the work anymore.
Is that what the title of your book is in reference to?
The title is a quote from a story that Maya Angelou wrote, an interview that she did with Nina in, I think, 1970, you know, which is really at this kind of pivot point for Nina's career. You know, after she moved in, you know, after she stopped, after she sort of gave up on the classical playing, you know, really the next big, she sort of moved everything that she'd committed to her classical study and really shifted that, you know, that determination and that belief into the civil rights movement and into, you know, fighting for racial justice in the country. And, you know, by the time you get to the late 60s and so many leaders have been killed, so many have been driven from the country. You know, there was the feeling that sort of the moderate victories of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, took a lot of the momentum out of pushing further for equality. She just, you know, she started to feel like she was the last one fighting and the last one still screaming. And by the time you hit the end of the 60s, she's sort of just as frustrated and angry about the way that the civil rights movement worked out as she was the way her own classical career worked out. And you get the feeling that, like, she took this one big bet, she lost that, she moved that to this second big bet. And when she was disappointed by that, that's really when she retreats and you know, really spends the rest of her life kind of directionless, because there isn't anything that was providing that kind of focus for her.
Wow. I mean, yeah, it when you read about Nina Simone, or you read about any of these artists who don't really recognize their own worth and they just kind of feel like they never fulfilled what they thought they could be. And I guess we all have that to a degree, but in particular someone who is an artist, whose stuff is out there that they can listen to, look at, get feedback from, it has to be a horribly frustrating thing to think, I'm not really doing what it is I think I'm best at.
Yeah, and I think with her there was also the sense of being, you know, of understanding her, you know, her gift and her talents and not feeling appreciated for that. I mean, it's kind of both things. It's the frustration of not connecting and feeling like, you know, that's on everybody else. That's not, I don't need to bend for them. I mean, there's a fascinating story that was very, you know, poignant because this came out right after David Bowie died. But she, essentially in the early 70s, she took her daughter to a Bowie concert at Madison Square Garden. And then later that night, coincidentally at a club, she went out and she ran into Bowie at this club. And he called her over and asked Nina to come sit with him and didn't really talk that much, but, you know, sort of held her hand and reached out to her. And then when she left, he said, "Is it okay if I call you?" And he called her that night at 3 o'clock in the morning and apparently then called her every night for the next month at 3 o'clock in the morning, every night. And finally came over to, you know, to visit her at her house in Mount Vernon. And she says that he said to her, you know, the difference between us is, you know, there are very few people who are out here where we are. There are very few people who understand what we're doing. But you really are a genius, and I'm not. You know, you have to do this, and you have to follow the music. And I'm not, I'm doing this because I know how to be a star. You know, I could see that and I could go after that. It's not like that with you. With you, there's this music that has to come out of you, and you can't let them change that. You can't, you know, for me, it's about seeing what's out there and knowing that I can take over the world. For you, you have to stay in that place where you make the music that you make. And an incredibly profound, you know, thing to say and exchange. And, you know, he then went on, I mean, like, sort of soon after that, he cut the song Wild as the Wind on the Station to Station album, which was a very Nina-associated song. She didn't write it, but it was a title song from one of her albums. So, you know, he did kind of complete that by doing this Nina song. And, you know, he didn't say in tribute, but, you know, in tribute to her. And that's a really, you know, I mean, that's a pretty haunting exchange that gets at a lot of stuff about, I think, about both of them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's one thing doing the show with May. I have learned from musicians that truly have it in their blood is there is this mutual admiration society among them, and they're fans too. And, I mean, May, you talk about John being a fan of Jonathan Winters. It's like, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people don't realize, I mean, you know, everybody else in obviously in the, you know, the baby boomer generation admires, you know, because the Beatles did change a generation, so it's a whole different thing. But John himself was like so in awe of the actors, the great actors of our time, you know, and I don't think this generation understands the real actors that we're talking about, the Cary Grants, the James Cagney. We sat. And when we were at the Cagney tribute, I mean, to sit there in a room of all these people that we admired, you know, you're looking at, you know, John Wayne or Kurt Douglas. I mean, those actors and actresses that are Mae West when she came in the door.
Right.
It was amazing. And there's John being like a little kid when he met Jonathan Winters at the Howard Cosell, you know, halftime thing,
right,
in L.A. I mean, he came running over to me. He goes, "Oh my God, I just met him. I just met him." Well, I said, "Who?" He goes, "Oh my God, I just met Jonathan Winters." And we talked about Jonathan Winters. I mean, you had to see him. It was like a little kid, and it was great to see because he didn't lose it. This was and. He even after meeting him, he didn't say, "Oh, I wish I'd never met him." It was, "Oh my God, I met my idol," and that was one of the things.
Two things. One is, I'm reading just Judd Apatow book. That's the interviews with comedians collection of interviews that he's done through his life, and I think it's Albert Brooks who talks about meeting John through Harry Nilsson,
right?
And how much, you know, how much John was, you know, obsessed with the comedians. And, you know, all of, they shared all of these common reference points because it was all these old comedy sketches, and like instantly they could start talking about that stuff. But
oh,
I'm
absolutely
curious, did John ever talk, did John ever talk about Nina at all? Because, you know, she did sort of a version of Revolution, not a cover, but kind of taking Revolution as a starting point. And she did a song called Revolution. And John, in some interview, said he thought it was really interesting what she had done with the idea from that song, and that he was really happy that she had kind of picked that up and run with it.
Well, you know what? We talked about a lot of different musicians.
Yeah.
So we never got a chance to stick with one. But
right.
He always admired, he thought that Nina Simone was so talented.
Yeah.
You know, they're because she was just above, even though they were around at the same time. You know, this is another, it's somebody that's on a different level, you know. It's that style of singing that, you know, he found it interesting. It's like when, who is it that sang, what was it, God Bless America, what was it, who's that woman?
Well, Kate Smith.
Kate Smith. I mean, can you imagine, her producer called up and said, could John Lennon play piano for Kate Smith? and, you know, and he was flattered. You know, I mean, he was flattered because he knew who she was, the whole
right.
thing. But he turned around and he said to me, just tell them that I'm flattered, but I'm only a three-finger piano player,
right.
so I'm not good with this one. So it was kind of, they want him to play piano yet.
I think the thing that I really, you know, I knew Nina's music. I love Nina's music, whatever. I knew the outlines of the story, but spending a lot of time, you know, really
right.
intensely thinking about her and listening to her, I think that, you know, the thing that really jumps out is how absolutely unclassifiable and unprecedented
yes.
the music that she was making was. You know, people called her a jazz singer, and she would get furious when they called her a jazz singer because she said, they're only saying that because I'm black. You know, the music that I'm making is not jazz. It's not sort of that group improvisation idea. That's not what I do. They're just being lazy. But, you know, so they called her the High Priestess of Soul, but she wasn't a soul singer like Aretha or Otis or, you know, those kind of soul singers. And she had this, you know, the range of her repertoire that went from, you know, standards to blues songs to like Israeli folk songs. She did, you know, a bunch of Beatles songs and Dylan songs and Leonard Cohen songs. She was she's one of the great Dylan interpreters ever, you know, and there's nothing that you can call the music that she did. It is so purely her own. And then when you listen to the singing and the piano playing, you sort of appreciate, oh, she was great at both of those things. But when you listen in these songs that she's playing these independent lines and playing, you know, real solos, you know, but from all of the things that she's listened to, her guitar player, who was her sort of career-long collaborator, said that Miles Davis once said to him, like, I don't know how she does it. I don't know how she can do both of those things at such a, you know, virtuosic level and so sort of independently of each other. She's not just accompanying herself when she plays. She's being the piano player and she's being the singer. And you just really, you know, the deeper you go into it, the more you realize, my God, she was just out there where nobody else was, you know, was making sounds like this.
Right.
Well,
oh, absolutely.
We're about to run out of time, Alan. And as always, as it was with the last time, fantastic interview. Thanks for letting us pick your brain. Now, if people want to get What Happened, Miss Simone, they can get it out all the regular
it's
outlets.
It's all out there, you know, in whatever, in bookstores, in ebooks, in whatever form you need. It's out there. And, you know, and if people haven't watched the film, if they haven't watched the documentary, it really, really is worth it. I mean, I think the DVD is coming out at the end of the summer or something, but it's on Netflix because they produced it. It's such an incredible story. And there you actually get the footage of watching her play, which is just, you know, astonishing.
Unbelievable. Well, Alan, we're gonna say ta because we're down to our last 40
yep.
seconds.
Thank
but
you guys.
Please come back when I'm sure you're about to write something else, and I hope you come back and share it with us.
Anytime, we'll keep you posted. It's always a pleasure.
Thank
cool.
you.
Take care.
Bye, you guys.
Bye.
That was Alan Light. He wrote What Happened, Miss Simone. And May, we are almost out of time.
We're out of time. I'll talk to you after.
I know.
Okay. Goodbye, everyone.
That's Miss May Pang. I'm Cynthia Nielsen. Thanks to Alan Light and his new book, What Happened, Miss Simone. You've been listening to Dinner Specials on Blog Talk Radio. Adios.